We're going to be back in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and this is really, as we've talked about, it's one of those monumental chapters in the New Testament, dealing broadly with matters of marriage and singleness and divorce and sexuality within the context of marriage and aberrations of sexuality that take place outside the context of marriage. You have this large handling of several distinct factors that were taking place in Corinth, circumstances that were significant and real for the people and the church there in Corinth, in a society that was riddled with all manner of illicit sexual activity. What was normal there was what we would consider to be aberrant in terms of the areas of sexuality and marriage and divorce and these things. Yet the Apostle Paul is coming at these matters with a level of practicality and directness that in some ways is not so easy for us to untangle and think about how to apply to our particular circumstance. Even some of the terminology has to be kind of identified and clarified as we look at this passage. But the more I've kind of been in this text and thinking about the subject matter that the Apostle Paul is addressing, I'm like you. I think about where we are as a society in our current day and time, and what has happened to the we might call it the institution of marriage, although that's probably not a really good biblical way to characterize it. But nevertheless, for the sake of our discussion and thinking about it, marriage is statistically on the decline in our society, but everything that permeates around marriage and home and family has been on the decline for a number of decades now, and it's clear. I think it's becoming increasingly more clear for anyone who's watching with a discerning eye, with the eye through the lens of biblical truth. We are seeing that as a society, we are indeed reaping the whirlwind. As a society and a culture, what is becoming pervasive all around us is merely the outworking of things that have been underway for decades. And much of it can be centered around what the Apostle Paul is taking up in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In fact, we've talked about this, I think we've at least alluded to it in past discussions. But you can even study history and you can see how the fall of empires is precipitated by diminished clarity and diminished virtue in the areas of marriage and home and family and sexuality. Like empires fall as a result of this kind of precipitating decline and decay. So, aren't you glad you're here? Isn't that exciting news? And as I've said before, as you know, as I'm sure you think about on your own, you don't need me to necessarily remind you of these things, but it is indeed true that when we consider the times in which we are living, particularly surrounding these matters that we have been discussing and will continue to discuss from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it places before faithful believers both a tremendous burden of responsibility and stewardship, but also enormous opportunity to shine as very bright lights in the midst of a dark and declining culture. And so I think that as we look at this passage, I'm just burdened and reminded of this reality that this is such important preparation and such important reminders and principles for us so that we can be effective lights, so that we can manifest to a world around us that is just completely riddled in confusion and despair and is working out that confusion and despair in all manner of wickedness and just destructive ways, we should say, that we have an opportunity to not only point to and speak about, but to demonstrate and to show a better way, a way that is centered fully in truth and in the redeeming work of Christ as we seek to live out whatever station God has us in. And this is what this text deals with when it deals with the issues of marriage and singleness and divorce. It points us to how we can, as people, the people of God, demonstrate clarity of perspective around what is true, and also demonstrate a degree of devotion and commitment to the glory of Christ in all things, so that we stand as beacons of light and truth in a decaying culture all around us. So with that level of intense burden that I think we all need to recognize and probably do recognize and really need to bear up under, I want to invite us to continue to look at this important section. And as I've talked about in past weeks, the context for this section really is important to understand in terms of what was going on in Corinth. And we talked about that over the last few weeks. We reviewed it last week, the different ways that marriage was established or different forms of marriage that were existent in Corinth. It was kind of all over the map. There was no sort of one set pattern or understanding of marriage in Corinth. It was a number of different forms that it took on. But also the culture was riddled with very loose understanding of sexuality within and outside the context of marriage. And that brought its own trouble into the thinking of the believers who are now trying to understand the teachings of the Apostle Paul about righteousness and holiness and what they are to abstain from, what they are to run away from, associations that they are to break off from, as he talks about explicitly in chapters 5 and 6 in particular. We see all of this play out in very pronounced ways here in chapter 7 as he's trying to address some very specific questions that had come to him by way of a communication from the Corinthians to the Apostle Paul, but also coming from them out of these particular sort of aberrant or unbiblical views of marriage and singleness and sexuality and divorce and so on. But as a way of just kind of getting our thinking reset around something that kind of emerged in my mind as I was thinking more about this earlier this morning, how many of you have actually been a part of the study since the beginning or since near the beginning of our study in 1 Corinthians? Okay, it's quite a few of you. How many of you have ever read 1 Corinthians before but prior to this study? Yeah, okay. So if you think back to chapter 1, when the Apostle Paul begins to introduce the trouble in Corinth, one of the troubled spots that he begins with divisions among them that he had heard about from Chloe's people. And I want to ask, this is sort of the only quiz I'll give today. How does the Apostle Paul characterize the nature of those divisions? Does anybody remember what he says? Some are saying, I am of... Right? Some are saying, I'm of Paul. Some are saying, I'm of Apollos. Some are saying, I'm of Cephas. Some are saying, I'm of Christ. In other words, the divisions that had ensued in Corinth centered around affiliation or allegiance, if you will, to certain leaders within the church. And the Apostle Paul has to go to great lengths to really break down all the thinking and all the bad theology and all of the bad understanding of what had been taught and who he was and who Apollos was and how to view leaders in the life of the church. He had to break all of that thinking down. But it's interesting to note that as we continue on throughout the letter, there are still echoes of him dealing with these allegiances to these leaders. And we'll see this play out even in this section in chapter 7 as we begin to look at it. He is not only dealing with all the various streams of marital relationship that existed, whether it be a more Judaistic form of marriage or a more traditional form amongst the nobility, which is sort of similar to the kinds of marriages that we would see today, or this tent companionship that was really controlled by slave masters of slaves, and it was tenuous at best. or whether it was the arranged kind of marriage where a father would essentially sell marital rights of his daughter to someone for money in an arranged marriage. All these different kinds of marriage practices that were existent there, he's addressing those and specifically dealing with those, but he's also in some fairly subtle ways addressing this these ideas of division that could be in play in their views of marriage that he's having to address as well. And we talked about last week the issue of abstinence or celibacy as the starting point for their line of questioning in this letter, where he says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." So he's raising this issue that they're bringing to him about the place of celibacy, and he's having to address it in one sense from the standpoint of those who are looking to him. I'm of Paul. And Paul, this is how you are. This is the status that you occupy. You are someone who is not married and is fully devoted to the mission and ministry of Christ. And so I am of Paul, and so I am going to pursue the same kind of virtue that the Apostle Paul would pursue. And he has to kind of unpack that and address that as he tries to deal with this sensitive and important matter around marriage. We looked at last time the first seven verses, and we basically identified what was the Corinthian confusion around marriage and sexuality. We unpacked that. We also looked at the Pauline instruction on marriage and sexuality. But today, we're going to focus our attention primarily on verses 8 to 16. And we won't get all the way through this section. In fact, we'll probably just get through the first portion of it. But we're going to be looking at these next few verses. And again, the Apostle Paul is continuing this very practical instruction for marriage, singleness, and divorce. The overarching study that we're talking about here is faithfulness in marriage and singleness. So regardless of the status that you're in, what does faithfulness look like and how does it play out? And we look at these verses today in verses 8 to 16, we see the Apostle Paul really dive into some further practical instructions on marriage and singleness and divorce through these verses. So let's read them together, verses 8 to 16. He says, "To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife?" Now clearly, this particular section deals mostly with issues surrounding marriage and the possibility or the reality of separation or divorce. But what I want to deal with today are these first two verses that deal with this matter of the unmarried and widows. He begins in this whole section by addressing the Corinthians by way of their marital status. That's what we're seeing here, is he's beginning to address these different groups based upon their marital status. You see this in verse 8, to the unmarried and to the widows. And then in verse 10, to the married. Then verses 12 to 13, to the rest, which is a reference to married believers with unbelieving spouses. See verse 12, if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and then in verse 13, if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever. And even down further outside sort of the section that we're looking at today, we'll get to it eventually, but in verse 25, now concerning the betrothed, this other category or status as it relates to marriage. This would be the never married. This is another reference to those who are engaged, and it's actually a technical term. We'll look at it in just a moment, meaning virgin. So it is a reference to the never married here in verse 25. So let's zero in. What are Paul's instructions then to those whom he refers to as the unmarried and the widows? What is he teaching here? Now, before we take up that question, we have to unpack who he is specifically referring to. Clearly, Paul is addressing two categories of unmarried persons. The widows, that designation is unambiguous, both in the text as well as just our understanding of the concept of a widow. It's not tricky. This is a reference to women who now find themselves single by way of the death of their husband. Very straightforward. But there is, however, some debate over who the unmarried category is representing. He refers to the unmarried as one category and to widows as another category. And then he proceeds with these instructions. Again, the widow reference is clear, but the unmarried is not so clear. And there's, in fact, scholarly debate over who he's talking about here. So we want to try to unpack that at least a little bit so that we can rightly understand what the Apostle Paul is teaching here. Some would argue that the Apostle Paul, in referencing the unmarrieds, or the unmarried in this passage, is simply referring to a mirror representation of the widow. So it would be him addressing the widow and the widower, or in the order of this text, the widower and the widow. In other words, they would just see this reference to the unmarried in this tight context of this verse as just the Apostle Paul's way of addressing only those who find themselves in a single status by way of death of a spouse, whether it's a man or whether it's a woman. And there are others who would take a different approach and who would see this in a different way. Some would argue that it's a mirror reference, but others would come at it from a different direction. And they would begin with the word itself, or the term itself. The term here for unmarried is agamos, or agamos. I'm not sure the exact pronunciation of that last syllable. And it comes from a word meaning wedding or marriage, but it just adds the negative, the alpha negative at the beginning, the negative prefix for not weddinged or unmarried. And interestingly enough, the term is only used four times in the New Testament, and every use is right here in this passage. So we probably would do well to try to understand the usage within this passage of this term and its four uses, to understand who he's referring to. If you look at verses 10 and 11, you'll see the next use, I should say, outside of the verses we just read in verses 8 and 9. In verse 10, he says, to the married I give this charge, not I but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but, verse 11, if she does, she should remain unmarried. There's the term. Or else be reconciled to her husband. So clearly, in this passage, in this section, in this use of the same term, unmarried, it is referring to someone who is divorced. If you have separated from your husband, which is another euphemism for divorce in this context, you should either remain unmarried, divorced, or be reconciled to your husband. Now, if you turn down to verse, or you look down to verse 32 and verses 34, you'll see the two other uses, or I should say, use number three and use number four. Number one is in the passage we're looking at today. The second one is the one we just looked at in verses 10 and 11, and then you have it two more times in verses 32 and 34, where he says, I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man, there it is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And then here it is again. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. So here, the first use in verse 32, you just simply see the term used to contrast an unmarried man with a married man and the concerns and anxieties and priorities that those two would have that are distinct. This is just a contrast of a married and an unmarried man. So not a lot of crystal clarity to distinguish what this unmarried might be referring to other than someone who happens to not be married. But is it someone who's divorced? Is it someone who is a widower? Is it someone who has never been married? What are we talking about? But then in verse 34, you see the term used again in a more specific form of designation and distinction where Paul speaks of women in two different categories. He refers to the unmarried or the betrothed. Now, the reason why these two are distinct is because they have very different meanings. As I said before, unmarried is simply the negative alpha prefix added to the term for married or weddinged. But betrothed is the word for virgin, and it's a clear designation of a woman who has never been married, as distinct from a woman who, in this case, was once married but is now unmarried. And based upon this context, kind of putting all this together, there is a rather compelling argument that you could make for viewing this reference to the unmarried as primarily a reference to those who were once married but are now divorced. It's not ironclad, you can't bank on it, but when you look at it in its totality and you see these different categories being set aside or in some cases set next to each other as a point of contrast, you certainly can make the case for that being a sound argument. I would land more on that side than on just seeing that as a reference to a widower. There's other linguistic reasons for that, but just note that this is not, in my mind, a reference to those who are just widowed or widower, a male or a female who is single by way of death of a spouse. So, in light of that, let's look now at what the instructions are for these two groups of people, these two categories of people based upon their status, their marital status. What is his counsel? Well, in verses 8 and 9, it's very straightforward in terms of what he's saying. He says, "To the unmarried and to the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion." The Apostle Paul's instruction here could be summarized, I think, as just that the good gift of singleness must be clearly discerned. To those who are unmarried by way of divorce, unmarried, widowed, they need to clearly discern whether or not they have this good gift of singleness that the Apostle Paul even ascribes to himself. He reaffirms that being single is good insofar as it is the status of a person who has the same gift that he has. And by sort of implied contrast, there is this understanding on the part of the Apostle Paul that it is an uncommon gift, that the majority of people who are of adult age are going to be inclined toward marriage or toward marital relations at minimum. And yet, those who find themselves in this single status, this single state, need to discern whether or not this is a gift that God has given them. Now, how do you discern that? Well, if you just look at verse 9, you get some inclination there, some indication there. He says, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, this is where understanding the context of Corinth has to be applied. This term, if they cannot exercise self-control, is a present tense verb in the indicative mood, meaning that it's a real action that is presently occurring. So what the Apostle Paul is addressing here are those who are unmarried by virtue of divorce or the loss of a spouse, who potentially are presently demonstrating that they do not have the self-control that is requisite to give evidence to the fact that they have this gift of singleness. So in that context, it's pretty straightforward. Those of you who find yourself in this position, primarily you Corinthians who find yourself in this marital status, if you will, the status of singleness under these circumstances, who are currently demonstrating your lack of self-control, need to recognize you do not have this gift and you need to pursue marriage, is what he's saying. Again and again, since we've been in this section, really going back to chapter 5, the Apostle Paul is laboring through this morass of sexual immorality that was so pervasive in the culture. So even getting down to the particulars of trying to address specific marital status or single status within the life of the church, he is still having to sort of unwind and untangle reality in the life of the church and reality amongst these people who were redeemed out of this kind of cultural morass. Imagine the difficulty of this kind of discipleship effort. That just strikes me as like this is your ministry. Now go and try to untangle all of that. It's pretty stunning. But it raises this issue that I think Gordon Fee captures well. He says, the issue for Paul is not the sexual drive as such, but the sinful practice of some of the brothers for whom marriage, rather than sin, is to be the proper order of things. That's what the Apostle Paul is driving the Corinthians toward. Remember, as we've talked about in the past, there was this this compartmentalization that was extant, and we know it too, but it was sort of an accepted compartmentalization even amongst those who were in an existing marriage relationship that was recognized for extramarital sexual activity to be in some ways accepted, just part of the culture, part of the practice, whether by virtue of the temple sort of prostitute apparatus or whether it be through concubinage. There was all manner of aberrant sexual activity that was so much a part of the culture. And the gospel comes through the message and witness of the Apostle Paul, followed by Apollos, and people are legitimately redeemed, but they're in this cultural morass, and he's having to address that explicitly. So it is incumbent upon those who are unmarried or widowed to assess the nature of this gift in their lives. It also points to the reality that this is not something that is a gift that is given and it's a permanent gifting for life. This also is an indication, and some would say that this section in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians is Paul's allusion to the fact that he is a part of the unmarried. It is unclear whether or not the Apostle Paul is unmarried as a result of being a widower or as a result of divorce. But because he was likely a part of the Sanhedrin, they were required to be married. These allusions in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it's likely that the Apostle Paul was once married. We don't know whether his wife thought he was now a complete wacko following this Jesus character, or and just abandoned him because of the Jewish tension and familial tension and all that would, the cultural tension that would be associated with that, or if he lost his wife to death. But nevertheless, the Apostle Paul is calling them to say, listen, you need to discern whether or not you have this gift as I now have this gift. And what I'm saying to you is that singleness is a good thing. As we talked about last time, there were those who were arguing from a Jewish perspective that remaining single was not a good thing. In fact, it was a violation of the command of God to be fruitful and multiply and to subdue the earth that we see in Genesis chapter 1, that you pursuing marriage was obligatory in the Jewish culture. And the Apostle Paul is saying it's not obligatory. If you have this gift, it is actually a good thing that you exercise this gift. Now, this is really about discerning the true nature of your devotion and the true disposition of your heart. Okay? And to understand this, if you just, we'll unpack this further when we get to it, but if just for a moment, if you'll look at verses 32 to 35, this lets you know where the Apostle Paul is coming from when he says that it is a good thing for someone to remain unmarried. This is part of the context of where he's coming from. He says, I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. Now, this is a point of clarification. When he's referencing that the married man or the married woman is anxious about worldly things, this is a general reference to the things of this earth, the stuff of this life, the realities of marital life, of home and family and children and those responsibilities that are tied to the physical dynamics, the material dynamics of those kinds of familial bonds and relationships. He's not necessarily speaking to worldly. I mean, think about the category that most of you find yourself in if he's just talking about that. Guess what? You're all completely worldly if you're married. Congratulations. Repent. I mean, what are your options at this point, right? So he's referring to the stuff of life, the bonds of these familial, these very real familial relationships that come about through the course of marriage. He's not referring to worldliness per se. But he is drawing a distinction or bringing clarity to what is a very real principle, a very real and practical principle. And that is this. There is no question that those who are unmarried, who are widowed, have the potential capacity for a degree of focus and an unrivaled service that exceeds that of married people. Bottom line, it is a practical matter. We don't really need to do the math on that, I don't think, right? The idea here, the principle here, is that marriage, particularly in the first century, most of the time entailed children. It was not just that the idea was this romantic notion of two people whose eyes caught one another across the town square and they fell madly in love and they eloped to whatever. I mean, these notions were not what was extant in the first century in that way. And on a very practical level, marriage, most of the time and very early on in the marriage, meant children. So the natural way that the first century mind would work would be that to get married is to begin a family and to begin to have children. That's just the way that it was. So when you compare that or really contrast that with the diminished responsibilities in this context of those who don't have those kinds of obligations and responsibilities, not to say that children are just an obligation or responsibility, but they definitely are. Let's be clear. But you know what I'm saying, right? And so naturally, when you see these verses in 32 to 35, and you see that the Apostle Paul is driving at this important matter that he's been driving at through the entire letter, this matter of eternal perspective that informs purposeful, passionate pursuit of devotion to God and all that he's called you to. And so you look out amongst a population of believers in the life of the church, and you see that there are those who are there who now find themselves in this unmarried state. And his perspective, his wish, his encouragement is that if you have this gift, then you should use it in full, unfettered devotion to the Lord. He says there in verse 35, I say this for your own benefit, not to lay a restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. Many people can get tripped up in this entire section, and many scholars have gone down a path of just really pigeonholing the Apostle Paul as someone who is completely anti-marriage and only wants to advocate various forms of singleness over against that anti-marriage position. And that's not the case at all. As I said at the very beginning, if you just look at this from the standpoint of practical, real talk kind of instruction, it's not hard to figure out what he's saying. And it is to uphold those who find themselves unmarried as potential models of devotion to the Lord and usefulness in the kingdom of God, as opposed to something less than that. It's for your benefit to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. In other words, being married is not a bad thing, but being unmarried frees someone up to demonstrate a capacity for time and investment to manifest in tangible ways a level of devotion to the Lord and a perspective about their calling and what is ultimately real and true that they can invest their lives in daily, moment by moment. And those who are unmarried and those who are widowed, he says, need to honestly discern whether or not that they have this gift of singleness in the same way that he has, and to exercise it according to what God has provided. Now, of course, the flip side is also true. Those who are in this status, who find themselves distracted by longings for companionship and intimate communion in the context of marriage, those who desire to restore or renew what they once had in marriage, this is not a bad or sinful thing, but it is definitely something that needs to be discerned. And as the Lord provides, marriage is something that can and should be pursued by those who have those kinds of longings and desires. Very simple, very straightforward. That is what he's instructing. And again, so much confusion around this was existent amongst the Corinthians at that time that they were thinking that abstinence was the only way to demonstrate virtue, or that sexual relations in the context of marriage were only to be entertained as a obligation for procreation, or that concubinage was the only outlet for any kind of intimate enjoyment, All these things were going on in the life of the church, and he's trying to bring everybody's attention and perspective back to, we need to be focused on devotion to the Lord and the working out of that devotion in the most fruitful ways that we can, with the recognition, as he'll talk about later in the chapter, that the Lord is coming, that the time is short, and we need to have that eternal perspective regardless of the state that we find ourselves. Now, he's going to go on to talk about this issue of various forms of divorce. Notice, again, there in verse 10, he says, to the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest, verse 12, I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. And on it goes with the unbelieving wife being sanctified or made holy by the believing husband and vice versa. Now, one thing that jumps off the page, we're going to unpack this much more deeply as we go forward, but one thing that probably jumps off the page for you is this reference to the Apostle Paul contrasting something that not I but the Lord has said versus what I, not the Lord, is saying. And some scholars have gone after this by saying that part of this is inspired and part of this is not. Part of this is the Apostle Paul making recommendations based upon his own personal preference or experience, and part of it is the Lord's words to his people. So just as a point of clarification for this particular section, when he references there in verse 10, I give this charge, not I but the Lord, the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. He is simply referencing what has already been the revealed teachings of Christ that the Corinthians would be familiar with. For example, in Matthew 19 or Mark chapter 10. And this is a reference to the nature of the marriage relationship, the permanence of it, and what God has joined together, man should not separate. And if there is a separation, then to remarry under unbiblical grounds is to commit adultery. That's sort of the summation. We'll look at this in more detail next week. That's sort of the summation of Jesus' teaching on marriage and divorce. You'll note, however, that the Apostle Paul here does not bring up what is often referred to as the exception clause in Jesus' teaching on marriage, and that is in the case of sexual immorality or adultery, divorce is allowed. And he doesn't bring it up here. Again, this speaks to the nature of the context of this letter. To bring up sexual immorality as an exception regarding instructions on marriage would give an out to probably almost every married person in the church at Corinth because of the nature of rampant sexual immorality in the life of that church. Here the Apostle Paul is simply putting the emphasis upon Jesus' teaching that the nature of your conduct as it relates to marriage and divorce in Corinth, and even in our day and time with the advent of no-fault divorce, where you can just, for really no reason, separate from your spouse, there was rampant divorce. There was a quote about women wearing out their bridal veils from the first century. I mean, a quote from the first century historian, women wearing out their bridal veils, divorcing and remarrying. Men who would just put women away, just set them aside. It was rampant. And here the Apostle Paul is simply invoking the Genesis 1 principle, the transcendent principles of marriage that were established by God himself as part of the created order that Jesus simply teaches again and really corrects the misapplication and really the abominable teaching of the Pharisees in that time on divorce and remarriage. But here, he contrasts that statement with what he is saying, not the Lord. This is not the Apostle Paul saying, you know, take it or leave it. What I say from here on out, you know, it's a toss-up. You'll notice at the end, let's see, where is it? Toward the end of the chapter, verse 40, he says, yet in my judgment, just wrapping up this whole section, well, verse 39, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. This is the Apostle Paul in a bit of a sarcastic tone saying, what I have written to you is from the Spirit of God, merely in the context of this section here regarding the married and their rationale for divorce and him correcting the record and then also providing another rationale that is acceptable for divorce, and then we'll talk about that next week. He is saying that this is a part where the Lord did not teach specifically on. Yet it is still part of the Spirit of God instructing us as his apostle, teaching you about these issues of marriage. Well, this is a huge section that I want to take time to really unpack, and I'm not ready to do that today. So I guess we'll finish a little bit early, and you can enjoy some extra time. Let's pray together.